world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Go now and pay later. That's what they say, whether you're taking a trip aboard an airliner, whether you're going on a cruise ship, an automobile trip with an RV or a trailer behind. The idea is whip out that piece of plastic, that credit card with your name on it, let them crank it through that funny little machine a couple, three times, and just trip off gaily into the yonder, because tomorrow may be too late. Every time I see some of these unbelievable advertisements that show these gay, happy families just throwing away all their cares and rushing off to Fiji or Samoa, the Hawaiian Islands or the Caribbean, I wonder about payday. I mean, when the people you bought all those airline tickets from say, okay, buddy, you've had your fun, now what about paying up? You know, the typical U.S. wage earner makes about $14,000 approximately, about $13,847 they claim, but in spite of the fact that the average individual is making more money than ever before, and of course we're hearing the people vying for presidential campaigns arguing about income tax and about what median income is, but approximately $14,000, that would, you would think, be a fair amount of money to all those people under that average. It's not very much money to all those people over that average. But in spite of that fact, the average family making that kind of money is still about $500 in the hole by the end of the year. Why? Well, because society is founded upon lust. Because basically society is utterly materialistic. Because advertising, entertainment, all the glitter, the glamour of our pre-packaged, processed, dyed, pummeled, misshaped, and fortified society around us, hanging on the hooks in the supermarkets, wrapped in plastic in our convenient throwaway container, advertises to us everything from vacations to homes to airplanes, automobiles, boats, and every type of labor-saving device, as well as gimmick and gadget to make our lives easier, happier, and more fun. And of course, we are going for that type of thing as never before. It's unbelievable when you stop to think back that only a few years ago we were in the midst of that terrible cold winter, the energy crisis, 68 degrees on the thermometers every place, a brick in the lav tap so we could save water, people canceling trips, airliners laying off pilots and crews, grounding airplanes, and people beginning to gird themselves for a long, cold winter. Drag out the long johns and wear your wool sweater because you didn't have the heat inside the home. The American people looked like they were going to get busy and solve the problem of becoming dependent upon other foreigners for their energy supplies. Oh, people were getting hurt, sure, I suppose. A lot of resort, motel, and hotel operators. Probably a lot of the quick food service establishments along the roadways. Probably some even of the various automobile supply and repair areas, the RV and the trailer, all those industries, well, they were in trouble too. Somebody was going to get hurt, but eventually, probably, the American people would have labored out of it all right. There would have been a rather shuddering readjustment of our economy downward, but we probably would have made it. But we weren't willing. And government came along to interfere in what the average American person was able to do for himself. So people begin to tell federal government, look, you do for me what I am not willing to do for myself. Not that we're not able to do it, but we're not willing to do it. And so federal government complies, and they come along to take away more and more of the individual responsibility of the American wage earner, the American homeowner, the American head of household. And they come along to take away more and more of the individual responsibility of local communities and of communal organizations, of local cities, of counties, and of state government. And so federal government grows larger and larger because people want to rely upon a type of a feather-bedded cradle-to-the-grave society where everything is taken care of for them. No, we wanted government to ensure that the flow of overseas oil would continue unimpeded. And so we depended upon government to somehow get over there, send Henry Kissinger, send somebody, and solve the problem. Calm down the Arabs, make them realize we had our back to the wall when we supplied the Israelis with the conventional weapons. Try to wind down the Arab oil embargo, pay them anything. Pay them quadruple, add 10%, 12%, and 20% more, and pay them that too. And did you notice here not so long ago when the Arab foreign minister of the Saudi Arabian nation just launched a little quiet threat kind of behind the scenes that found its way explosively into headlines across the country that maybe a new Arab oil embargo was in the works. Now, that was reported out of Cairo that Saudi Arabia had threatened to impose a new oil embargo against the United States if Congress were to enact that legislation aimed at weakening the Arab boycott. So what we've seen so far in the presidential debates, in President Ford's promise to release the names of those firms indulging in the boycott, engaged in it, and the subsequent releasing of some of the names of those firms by the appropriate department, even though we saw a denial by the Saudi Arabian foreign minister that he had threatened it, you sure saw Washington hop around real quickly and get into the act. And then real quickly you saw reassurances that all of those very sophisticated weapons we are selling the Saudi Arabian government would be delivered right on schedule. So the American government stepped in to provide a period of time, we don't care, it seems, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, or five, just so we have it during our lifetime, where we can continue to enjoy our gas-gulping toys, where we don't have to wind down our standard of living, but where we can continue to wind it up. And even as we wind it up and earn more money, we continue to reach out to grasp and to buy, to purchase on time installment buying and on pay now, go later plans, or rather the other way around. We ought to do it pay now and go later, but we don't. We go now and pay later. And so then when payday comes, we don't have the money. And most average Americans, even those earning about $13,847 a year, are living about $500 per annum above their annual income. According to a leading bank, the average person simply doesn't have enough savings to last very long to even make the monthly payments on car and home. And there was quite a dreary financial portrait painted of the typical wage earner in the United States by drawing heavily upon data kept by the federal government. And what you see is a person in his late 30s, probably married and a father of two, who earns about $14,000, lives in a modest but comfortable home, complete with all the electrical appliances, and he has color TV, and he probably has a recreational vehicle, maybe a motorcycle. His kids have both got scooters or bicycles, and he drives a fairly new car. Now, his problem is that he needs about $14,333 to maintain a moderate standard of living, but he's only making $13,847. That bank revealed that the average wage earner never has more than around $50 lying around the house, and that his checking account generally falls below zero at month's end. That he, in every sense of the word, is broke by about the 28th of the month on the average month. 2 days later, 3 days later, if he can go to the bank, get that check in there to cover a couple that he's already written, he barely survives. It's like a man who has already been torpedoed and he's out in the sea. He is bereft of water wings, blown up balloons, or any flotsam or jetsam to which to cling. And so, as these waves come along and great big huge swells, which is like the monthly cycle of paycheck to indebtedness, he is going under. And every time, just as the wave passes, you see his head disappear, well, he bobs up to the surface again, blowing and sputtering and wondering whether or not he's going to survive. Along comes another big wave and he goes under. And this is the way the average wage-earning family is living in the United States. They go under about the 28th of every month to emerge sputtering with a gasp of amazement that they survived about the second or third. Now, how to avoid living hand-to-mouth? Do you know that some people don't have the faintest idea how to get off that unbelievable merry-go-round? It would never occur to them to bring down their expenses. It would never occur to them to quit spending. Why, they're told by television ads that the way you make money is to spend, which saves. Why, I saw this bright, apple-cheeked couple recently in a television commercial that talked about going to a leading department store. They were just brand newlyweds. They even made a joke about the baby, and of course it was a dog. They said they'd been married for only a few months or a few weeks. We got married just the other day, the ad goes. And we saved $100 here, and $200 there, and $600 the other place. And so they wheel across in front of you a big washer and a dryer, an electric range, a color television set that costs over $600, and they said, we saved so many hundred on this, and we saved so many hundred on that. I thought, now, isn't that amazing? Where did they put all that money they saved? Is it in a bank account? Is it in a savings account, a regular passbook account? Are they turning it over every 30, 90 days on CDs? They got it in futures? Or where is all that money they saved? Well, that's just a funny word. You know, I wish Ralph Nader and some of his law team would get after some of these advertisers one of these days and make them completely do one of two things. Either change their advertising or else rewrite Webster's Unabridged Collegiate Dictionary. Because the words that they used are the exact opposite of what these people were really doing. The people were not saving in this ad. The people were spending. Now, what the ad might say if they are alleging that they actually will give you this or that product for so many dollars less than some other competitor, what they ought to say is that you spend comparatively less, or you spend proportionately less, or you will spend a little less by buying with us, but you are nevertheless spending. But to use the word save $100 is absolutely false. It is untrue. It is a lie. It flies in the face of the meaning of the word save. People apparently are so gullible they think they are saving while in fact they are spending. Do you know that it's gotten to the point that people... Now, this is stupid, but people can't afford to die. Can't afford it. Bank account won't stand it. And yet people are dying like flies from all kinds of diseases, but they can't afford it. We've done several programs in the past, not only the broadcast on radio, but also television interviews, including the one where we interviewed a lot of people who are morticians who make their living by the layaway plan. Anyway, we found out that many people go completely down the drain, the remainder of the family, the widow, the widower, the children, when the wage earner dies. And most people's financial affairs are so utterly chaotic that they literally can't afford to die. The typical wage earner that makes that average $14,000 might have amassed, by the time he's 38, a little modest estate with a net worth of about $38,000. That would be by selling his clothes, his gun collection, his golf clubs, his fishing equipment, his used automobile, his color television set, and his kitchen appliances, and whatever little bit of equity he's got in his home or his recreational vehicle, or maybe his kid's scooter and bicycle to go with it. And so his net at the time of his death would be about $38,000. Now, if he dies, he's going to have to leave that to the wife, but the best bet would be to make sure that the wife draws it out the day before he dies, or the federal government or somebody else might come along and seize it while it's still in the bank. I don't know exactly how that works, but somehow it seems that they told me that if you want to leave, let's say you've made a little bit of money, you want to leave your grandkids some money. Well, don't just leave it in your estate or your account, because apparently if you die and those grandkids come along saying, hey, it says right here in his will that he wanted to give us a few thousand apiece, the federal government's probably going to say, I'm sorry, we've already spent that. But your typical wage earner has a small estate with a net about $38,000. Now, he's going to try to leave it with his wife, but, you know, if that proves to be so, she's probably going to have to go out and get a job immediately after his death if she doesn't have one already. Because, you see, besides about 22.5 equity in the house, the typical wage earner's other principal assets would be about, oh, 4,000 and a half accumulated cash in life insurance and maybe 1,800 or so in savings. And his debts would be such that most of that would be wiped out. The average wage earner carries around, oh, 10, 20, 30,000 life insurance, not a really big one, say about 10,000 through the average employer's plan where he has a group insurance program at the factory or wherever he works. And really, as people will find in an emergency, especially if there's a protracted illness, some type of disability or an accident, and then final death, where it took a lot of days in the hospital and intensive or special care, that $10,000 doesn't even touch what the costs are going to be if the poor guy kicks the bucket. So the wife is left, actually, with instead of an estate, she's left with the need to go to work to keep life and limb and those kids together. But, you know, the people desire to get things. The principal desire we have with us is the credit card philosophy of get, of buy, of spend, of go now and pay later. And then people wonder why in the world they have money worries. You know, we right now have a total U.S. debt on its way toward $3 trillion. $3 trillion. Out there back in 1954, the U.S. debt was about $606 billion, or below $1 trillion. It climbed above $1 trillion by 1964 to be $1 trillion and $15 billion. But now it's on its way toward $3 trillion with $68 billion federal deficit and ballooning government debt. You know, bankruptcy for America's biggest city is virtually certain. All they try to do is to stave it off a little while in various mop-up operations and so on. And we focus our attention on all the graft, the chicanery, the rip-offs, the money under the table, people with their elbows up to the edge of the barrel and the till, and they're just ripping off whatever program they're over. But, you know, really, even though a lot of the average American people like to accuse and to criticize, whether it's organized crime or the white or the blue-collar worker who is ripping off the boss, you know that almost everybody operates on the same criteria. Almost everybody operates on the same laws or principles or absence of them when it comes to money matters. The whole nation is living beyond its means. The truth is that the American economy sits here on a mountainous pile of public and private debt that totals nearly $3 trillion. That amounts to about $13,000 for your newborn babe of 2 days ago. The average American child is born into the world owing $13,000. They're so large that it's incomprehensible when you stop to think about that, but we're not willing to do anything about it. Since World War II, a whole new type of money psychology has made inroads into the thinking of the American people. A large number of people don't feel it is necessary or even wise to save money. There has been a disappearance of the work ethic. It is a much maligned ethic. People equate that with fundamentalist religions, with old Quakers in square hats, with Amish and strange-sounding sects and organizations of a religious bent. They talk about the Judeo-Christian ethic, and they talk about the Protestant work ethic, as if Catholics didn't ever believe in work. And it's absolutely unbelievable, this new money psychology, spend what you don't have for what you don't need and what you can't pay for, but spend it nevertheless. Now, much of this thinking stems, of course, not only from the unbelievable spiraling rise of affluence around us, but also the runaway inflation with which we grapple today. A dollar worth 100 cents in 1959 is worth 61 cents or less today. According to federal statistics, a family that tripled its income between 1940 and 1970 is no better off in terms of real purchasing power. As a matter of fact, has perhaps diminished a little bit in purchasing power. So as a result, millions of families have lost interest in trying to accumulate any what is really devalued money. I happen to know many young people who think about getting married. They want to set up housekeeping, and they're willing to do it on $100, $200, or $300. They're willing to do it on less than that, if necessary. Now, if they can borrow from father-in-law or mother-in-law or someone else a few $100 for the wedding, and get another cash gift of $100 or $200 to help out with the honeymoon, and if he has some little moderate job in which he's making maybe $3.50, $3.75 an hour, which a lot of people will tell you is awfully dirt cheap, poor wages, that's it. That's all they need. He doesn't need to own a home, own a piece of property, have any real guaranteed secure job, such as being in business for himself. He can be a factory worker, a warehouseman, a truck driver, a bus driver, an assembly line man on some production line someplace, whose job can be subject to the vagaries of everything from the whims of Arabs to the weather. But they're going to go right ahead and spend it and get in debt anyway. So the intensity of this modern money trouble is going on and on at an ever-spiraling rate upward, and you do not have the faintest idea at how quickly such seemingly utterly disconnected events as a drought in the Central Valley of California, a drought in the western growing states of the United States of America, the whims of Arabs and rising oil and energy prices abroad, a bobble, a fumble, or a mistake by the federal government in foreign policy can come along to wipe out, utterly wipe out, financially, hundreds of thousands, millions of American families. But it can happen, and it does happen just that way. And we don't seem to know what to do about it. Now, you know, the money problems of the average person are not little problems. They're the things that concern most people most of the time. It's amazing to me, in a time of the global dilemma of the geopolitical struggles in which this world is engaged, in our nuclear-armed world of detente, of standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States, in a time where we now feel the Soviet Union may have gained a strategic superiority, not just parity, against the United States' nuclear capacity for massive retaliation. A time of the toppling of governments of the average of about one a month. 1976, the worst year in history for freedom, the cause of freedom suffering by 619 million people in the nation of India, going into a type of despotic government where they lost most of the freedoms that they had. A time of a bizarre repetition of those months just prior to the beginning of World War II, when the global problems are so enormous, and in spite of that, in spite of it being our bicentennial year, in spite of it being an electorate year, a year of electing a president who will be not only the president of the greatest nation on the face of the earth, but the Western world, and one of the key figures in the entirety of humanity and all of our destinies collectively together, nevertheless, believe it or not, one of the most oft-voiced issues, one of most emotion and most constant concern for the average voter in the American public is his bank account. It is his job. It is his personal income. It is what he has, what he possesses, what he hopes to buy. It's what he promises his wife and his kids. It's what he hopes for the future. It's money. So in spite of all of these other enormous, vast, almost incomprehensible global issues we face, the average American will vote for the man he thinks is going to give him more money, is going to give him less work, more leisure, more fringe benefits, a guaranteed national health insurance program, a guaranteed minimum wage, a four-day and maybe later a three-day work week. More things, more goods, more services, more money, less work, more leisure time. That's where it's at, because our values are utterly backward and upside down. Because the average American person is brainwashed with all the TV ads and everything else that tell him his work is something he needs to get away from. You never see anybody advertising your work is what you ought to get back to. You never see anybody talking about what a wonderful job, what a stimulating, inspiring, exciting challenge it is, what a reward it is just to be involved in the work in which a person is involved. No, never. It's something, leave that behind. That jades you, it exhausts you, it enervates you. Get away from that and get off over here to Tahiti and spend yourself about $10,000 you haven't made yet and can't afford and get in debt. Go around waving that useless piece of plastic with your name on it. Let those people crank it through that machine. You don't have to pay for it. All you got to do is just go buy, go spend. And of course, you're not spending. They tell you you're saving. I don't know. Too many millions of Americans are spendthrifts that are living way beyond their means. I guess they're following the example of the federal government. And they're the worst spendthrifts and wasters that there ever have been. It's unbelievable, but the truth is that the American economy is sitting on a mountainous pile of debt, public and private, totaling now nearly $3 trillion. And those figures are so high that it's almost impossible to comprehend. Well, I've got a booklet here that will go right through the entire modern money psychology that gives you an analysis of a lifetime of income and outgo for Mr. and Mrs. median income plus child. It gives you four principles for financial stability. Now, to give you a little rehearsal of what's in this free booklet, and by the way, this has nothing whatsoever to do with a money-making scheme. This does not tell you about some course you need to take. It doesn't tell you about something you need to buy. It doesn't tell you about money you need to send anyone. It is a free booklet in the public interest, for the sake of the average median citizen of the United States of America who is living beyond his means and needs to know how to get out of debt, that gives you principles for financial stability. For example, operate on a cash basis. Now, wouldn't that be a stupid thing to say to most people? Don't buy until you can pay cash. But you know, people just don't even think of that anymore today because it is just not done. I just don't know if you know of anybody who operates on a cash basis. The fact is, though, that most money today is not real money, but is represented only by so many pieces of ink on a ledger or a piece of paper. The company that pays you never handles real money. They get a sheet, they get checks, they get various documents that claim that so much money is deposited in a bank, and the bank has papers that say somebody else deposited so much money to the account of that corporation when their bills came due, and their various suppliers and so on that pay them money, or vice versa. So you get a check, and you deposit that in your bank, and you write out paper. Now, once in a great while, if you write out a check in round numbers or you cash a check to get a little bit of cash for incidentals or for entertainment or going out to dinner, and a lot of times most people do that on credit cards, but you might be able to handle a little bit of that stuff they call money, which in itself really is not money, I guess. It's kind of worthless when you think about it, especially the paper kind. They long since took away that little statement on the paper bills that claim you could go at any U.S. Reserve Bank and demand that in lawful money, which in those days was gold or silver. But, of course, they've already clipped those coins and watered it down, taken those out of circulation. They're worth 4 or 5 times as much as they used to be now, which shows what your paper money's worth. But on a personal level, I suppose you could say that credit cards eliminate nuisance and maybe save you the worry about carrying cash and all that, and they can provide convenient identification and all of that type of thing. So there's a lot to be said for them. But on the other hand, most families are suffering from overuse of that credit card. And even when you don't have the money, the lust is there, the desire is there, the want is there. So you reach out with a credit card and say, well, here, and crank it through and say, well, nuts, I can enjoy this, I can eat it, I can watch it, I can smell it, I can roll around in it, I can drive in it, I can go someplace in it, but I'll try to pay for it later. But consumers ought to understand that buying on credit creates a completely false illusion of prosperity. Too many people like to equate spending money with growth, but spending money they don't have. You know, not long ago, I was looking around trying to replace an old used aircraft with another used aircraft that wasn't quite so old. And I found a man, a very helpful banker, who would loan me more money by far than I wanted to borrow. Now, I was tempted to borrow as much money as he was willing to loan me to get into a much newer aircraft, but it would have been an aircraft I couldn't afford to pay for. I had to decide to borrow comparatively less money and to get an aircraft that was several years older than I might have been tempted to buy, in order to bring my payments within a range that I could handle. But you know, I was looking at having to pay that money back. If I'd only looked at how much money he was willing to loan me, why man, I guess I could have gone head over heels into debt and never emerged from now on. And I'm afraid that's what a lot of people tend to do. If they can find the money, well, they'll borrow. But you know, when you borrow, sometimes payday comes, and I mean payback day, when you have to pay it back. But once you get caught in that credit trap, and so many families are going into bankruptcy and businesses failing and so on today, it just seems like there's no way out. But if you want an emergency method of getting out of debt, the principles of how to do that, and on budgeting, on trimming the food fat and rent, and about your working wife, whether it's a burden or a help, a bigger law about finances, and further reading suggested in this booklet, then write for this booklet on ending your financial worries or managing your personal finances. Just mention the booklet on finances. And write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. It's free of charge, and by the way, it is not a money-making scheme. It's just good, sound advice to the average wage earner and householder in the United States. Or you can dial a toll-free number. They're waiting to take your call right now at 800-423-4444 for that free booklet on finances. That's 800-423-4444, or write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.